I'd like to invite you up at this time.
Good evening. My name's Carolyn. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, Kevin, for badgering me for 9 months. I moved here in October. I think I got to know Kevin like the week after we got here. But it's a privilege to do service, and I know that, and that's been my experience. And but this is a different format than anything that I've experienced in my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, which started in Arizona and then moved to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, and then moved some places around Europe for vacationing, and then to Vermont, the home of our founders, Bill Wilson, born in East Dorset. Great place to go visit, as his home's been maintained by a foundation. And Dr. Bob Smith was born and raised in St. Johnsbury. And we lived, about 9 miles south of there. Anyways, if you have a chance to go to St. Johnsbury, which is in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, that's, they have his boyhood room redone just as it's imagined, or the archives say it was looked. And anyways, so in all those travels, I got sober October 31st, 1983. I haven't been to a legacy meeting, nor have I ever been taped. So I, but the reason I'm here, the reason that most of us that have done the steps keep coming back, all of us, presumably, to stay sober and to pass it on. So I'm really happy tonight, because I know that there's some newcomers here, and some folks that maybe haven't worked the steps yet, or maybe are kind of getting back at it. So hopefully this will be helpful to you. When I started working the steps, I relied on my sponsor relied on the Big Book of AA solely. At that time, it was the third edition, and as you may know, the first 164 pages have not changed since actually the first edition. And this is the fourth edition that I was given for free by the Brown Bagger Group over at Fairview. Appreciate it. Over the course of the next 5 weeks, I'll bring some of my other big books. They're more impressive. They have like duct tape on them. they're really underlined and what have you. These little tabs were put in at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and those are maybe some quotes that I'll read out of. I did use as a reference, just as a quick guide. This is a book written by a guy named Wally P., who's was out of Tucson. I never met him. I don't know if he's still alive. But it's called Back to Basics, and it relies solely on the Big Book of AA. And it's been used, what he did was kind of follow the guideline of how they did it, the old-timers did it, starting back in 1940. And what they did was take groups of people through the steps in 4 evenings. And they had it divided up like that. So I didn't actually model the fact that I'm doing 5 evenings after this, but it's helpful because it refers, as I say, to the Big Book. When I was new, I was very well-educated, maybe a little over-educated, but when I got here, I couldn't read the Big Book. It just didn't make any sense to me, and I didn't understand the language, which I've now become familiar with. It's the language of the heart, that's what we call it. But the concepts in there just didn't make sense to me. And so my sponsor suggested, and it was kind of the general suggestion to my home group, which was the Southside group in Tucson, Arizona, was that we rely on the big book. The I've come to appreciate the 12 and 12, which was written by Bill Wilson, and it's kind of his essays about the steps. But what I'll be talking about is pretty much, as I've said now, ad nauseum, out of the big book. The big book was written in it was published actually in 1939. AA got started in 1935, and what happened, one of the concerns, was that, as we know, it's the magic, the beauty, how we pass it on is one drunk talking to another. Well, when word got out that there was a program that worked for alcoholics, there was a concern among the people, which I guess were about 100 folks, that they wouldn't be able to handle the number of people that they'd be inundated by people. So the idea was to get some literature going that could address some of the questions and stuff that people had. The other reason, one of the other important reasons for publishing the big book, was to make some money. And I'm not going to go into great history. You can read that in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and AA Comes of Age, other books that I've thumbed through. I can't say that I've read them cover to cover. But anyway, so they did sell shares to make some money to keep what that started to be a what is now the big central office in New York. But and I haven't been to Akron yet. As I said, we just moved here. And so there's probably people in this room that know a whole lot more about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and as it arose out of Akron than I do. But I just wanted to to give a little background of the big book. And my friend Ken told me, we were talking on Zoom this afternoon, that the big book, which is actually entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, became the big book because it was a big book. When it was first published, it had really thick, coarse paper, I guess post-World War I. And now, and you'll see this in a footnote in the fourth edition, it's translated into 73 different languages. And when we lived in the Middle East, they just had finished the Arabic version. And we actually knew a guy whose story is in there, so that's kind of cool. As I said, I got sober October 31st, 1983. And the first step, as we have it on the wall and read it at every meeting, is that we would admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. When I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor suggested that I write down 20 incidences that I could see in my life that were incidences where I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. So these are a few of them. I was raised in Lake Forest, Illinois, in Glencoe, and then moved to Lake Forest when I was in first grade, and I lived there until I went to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Some of you may be familiar with the North Shore of Chicago. It's really pretty. it's real nice. And I had my parents did the very best that they could to raise my brother and to raise me. And my dad was in the real estate business, and I was told that he wasn't home at night because the people he was doing business with were business people, businessmen, and they were home and available to him in the evening, which was true, and he was an alcoholic. So I didn't see him under the influence much at all, but the behaviors that we learned to any of you that have been around alcoholics other than yourselves know about that pussyfooting around, that walking on eggshells, that being careful on Saturday morning. When I was, I never watched cartoons after I came, my dad came down one morning and said, "Oh, you're wasting your time," and turned off the TV, and I guess I was wasting my time. So I never watched any of those cartoons, at least when he was home. We watched, we got to watch in the evening. Like I said, he wasn't home. So anyways, I started my drinking of what I like to call as the behind the gym drinking, where I go into my parents' liquor cabinet with some old bottle from the kitchen, a jar, a nice screw top, and just take a little bit of everything. A little cream de mint, a little vodka, a little Jim Beam, a little grenadine for color, I guess, and meet up with the friends at the dance, and have that as kind of a starter. And I loved it. I felt great. It filled me. I felt before that, I mean, I wasn't particularly socially awkward. I was a popular girl. I lived in the same town from first grade through high school. As kind of chaotic and unstable as alcohol made our family, from the outside, we were looking good, and we were very stable. And that is that we lived in the same place. So anyway, but I did like that feeling where I could be more comfortable around other people, be comfortable in myself. And I heard a speaker say this once, I loved it. She said she felt like a piece of Swiss cheese, and when she had that alcohol, it just filled up all those holes, so she just felt okay. And that was my experience from the very beginning. And from the very beginning, I blacked out. I got drunk the first time I remember, and somehow got home from the dance that was just, we lived close to town, so it was down the street, and passed out in my backyard. I couldn't get up the back steps. There were three of them, you know. So anyway, that's how I started, and that's how I continued. I was, if I could piece together the night before, I pretty much figured, well, I wasn't drunk. See? I mean, this was later on. This is not when I'm dinking around at age 14 wondering if I have a drinking problem. I thought I'd found the solution. A lot of fun. I did Little Geographic when I was a teenager. My cousin lived about 10 miles away, and in my hometown, my high school, I was a class officer. I was a very good student. I was, had a lot of friends. Different groups of friends, though. Never just one group. Just, I would stay with these people and behave like them. Then I'd go to this group and behave like them. And then I'd go to this group. And those various groups were studious and drinkers. And but down in Glenview, they were just flat-ass wild. And her parents, my aunt and uncle, went out a lot. They were bowlers and golfers and what have you, so we had lots of parties at Judy's house. And so I kind of, as I say, we talk about the double life in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was me from real early on. I learned how to be kind of phony in all situations. I could do whatever the situation demanded. And some of that's a character defect, and some of it actually has been pretty adaptive over time, but I see it for what it is now. I went to college. I got through college because I associated with a lot of people that didn't drink. I joined some Christian organization, and so that was, again, I learned that behavior of hang with the people that whose behavior I wanted to model. But when I wasn't with that group, when I would go home and be with my high school friends or whatever, we're up at the Lantern drinking, blacking out, who are you and where are we, that kind of behavior. And after graduation, I graduated with a degree in psychology, really useful. Even in 1978, 79, I had gone to Europe for almost a year. And, well, back then, they might still, Patricia might know this, there was a lady that sold wine, and I guess they made it somewhere near, and there was kind of a cask, and you just take your bottle, and she'd fill it up, and it was the equivalent of 50 cents, which was great. And I made sure that my education didn't get in the way of my education, and I got into some scrapes, shall we say. You know, I got lost in Vienna, but I was with another girlfriend, and she found me, and I think to this day she probably saved my life. But we know that's what we do. We do in AA. We go out, we get drunk, can't remember where we are, or you know where the car is, or who we are. And that, I don't recommend that in Europe. It's not great for a 22-year-old. But anyways, I did. I was still having a good time. And so anyways, I graduated from college after that and got a job with an organization. This is all about powerlessness, by the way, and unmanageability. This is step one. Got a job with Ralph Nader. I'm not sure Ralph Nader is still, I guess he's still with us. But anyways, what they were doing back then in the late 70s was getting gobs of young people to go door to door in the Midwest and collect money for Ralph and his causes. And I was really good at that. And it was really easy to skim off the top. And so I get my quota, and then I just keep what, you know, the extra. So I was getting by, and I hope I remember that when we get to step nine. Anyway, so I only lasted there about 7 months because everybody liked to drink, and I thought they were drinking like me, but they weren't. I was passing out. I was, you know, throwing up in somebody else's place and not showing up on time. And there was another person who, of course, was my quick friend, Bob. And they said, "You're like Bob. You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And so I was like, "I don't need to go to AA." I had a cousin, that uncle that lived in Glenview that went out a lot. He went to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was kind of in and out, but I knew about AA because of Uncle Bob. And I was like, "No, I don't need to go to AA." Well, about 8 months into the whole thing, I had to deliver myself to a psychiatric hospital. I'm going to tell this part of my story in step two. But anyways, I'd been in the world of psychiatry. I'd been turned over to the world of psychiatry by my parents. Nothing wrong with it. If people have psychological problems on top of alcoholism, we need help. I wasn't honest with them. I didn't tell them what I was drinking. Anyways, the state of Illinois called my mom in Arizona. By that time, she'd moved out to Tucson with her new husband. And my stepfather, my dad had died. Anyway, they said, "You need to come here and get her, or we're going to commit her." And I think that this is a really important point, because all along, my mother never believed that I was just a plain old alcoholic. She thought for sure that these people that I was hanging out with were slipping me drugs. You know, that I had got into the somehow that Haight-Ashbury had moved to Chicago. You know, that I was, you know, not. How could alcohol be responsible for this her beautiful daughter? You know. Beautiful, lovely, adorable Missy is what they called me. Not at this point. That was, you know, back when I was like five. Anyway, state of Illinois said, you got to come and get her, we're locking her up. So she came to get me. And by that time I was on, back in the day, women went a lot to, I've found this when I've talked to other women that are my age, which is 66, to mental care, but psychiatric care, mental hospitals and what have you. I think a lot of men got locked up for crimes, but women largely, my experience and that of other women, has been in the psychiatric world. So I was on Thorazine and Stelazine, and they forgot to give me the thing that makes it so you don't have lockjaw. So there I get off the plane in Arizona. It's 110, and I'm drooling, and I can't open my mouth. So they got me to the psychiatric help, and gave me the right pills at least, so I could open my mouth. I like this part of the description of women. It's some of my favorite four lines in the big book that's devoted to us women, and here it is. It's on page 33, more about alcoholism. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time nor take the quantities some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. And that certainly was my story. So that's how I moved to Arizona. I never tell anybody how I really moved to Arizona like that unless I'm in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go, oh, it was too cold in Chicago, you know, or something like that. I slowed down on my drinking because I was living at my parents' house. My mom liked to drink a lot, and so she was kind of my one of my best drinking buddies. And we just drank that cheap white wine. You got it Safeway. Back then it was $2.69 for a nice big bottle, kind of shaped like this. And I learned a lot of family history that way. Stuff like my dad had been married before. Didn't know that. Stuff like my aunt had been married like three times. Didn't know that. Found out her opinion of why the aunt and the uncle don't talk anymore. You know, all sorts of stuff that only comes out after about a half a bottle of, or maybe a bottle of wine. So I worked for a while at a children's home, those poor kids. I mean, a good day for me was when they all ran down the driveway, ran away. They were pre-adolescent children. It was the only treatment center in Arizona at the time. I laugh over this because nothing bad happened on my watch that I'm aware of. And some of those girls stayed in touch with me for a long time. But anyways, I knew that wasn't for me. I was not going to be a social worker. So much for the psychology degree. So what do you do then? You're not good at math, social work, become a lawyer. So my father told me he thought that would, before he died, that he thought that would be really a good fit because I could talk. And I cared about people, I could help people and make some money. So I got into the University of Arizona. I liked it. I drank a lot. And I studied and drank. I found a best friend, and we just drank, you know, in the evenings, and then there was lots of parties and what have you. I had some self-discipline. So I didn't drink until like 6. And there was a lot of competition, and I had a lot of fear. And so I was always looking for 6 o'clock to come. And that went on for about 3 years. Law school's 3 years. And I worked some jobs and engaged in a lot of inappropriate behavior. And didn't get caught. And what is described of the alcoholic is in the doctor's opinion. And when you get your big book and you start reading it, don't start at Bill's story. Start back at the very beginning, you know, the little teeny-weeny Roman numerals. And this is Roman numeral XXVIII, 28. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And that was certainly true for me. And I related to that. I'll be honest, it was not for a couple years did I ever read the doctor's opinion or was I directed to that. The other few sentences that kind of resonate with me, and I hope with the new people in the room, would be, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. And so my thing about law school and that was, it was kind of my identity. I grabbed onto it and thought I could hold that up and nobody's going to go behind that facade. And I told you I learned early on how to create these facades, you know. And but what happened, of course, is that there's a 3-day exam for that profession, and I was sober the first day and had a couple drinks before the second, and then the third day I was really badly hungover, and so I didn't get my meal ticket. I passed part of the test and I didn't pass the other. Fortunately, the place I worked was they were nice enough to keep me on. They needed the work and they didn't have to give me a raise because I wasn't a lawyer yet. And but what happened is that my facade crumbled. I was like, oh no. I'm sure I said, oh no. And I knew before, I mean, the test was in July. I knew the day I walked out of it that I didn't do well. And so my last drink was not nearly my worst. I'm going to backtrack a little. We're at step two. Came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I always believed in God. I went to traditional church. As I said, I had a lot of friends and associations with Christian people, Christian groups. But I never, until I got to AA, knew how to access God, how to have God really work in my life. And so that came through kind of what my sponsor said was, take a look at what you've gathered up all your life about God and strip it away. And I'm going to say that this was my second sponsor. I didn't really work the steps until I'd been sober 2 years. The first time I came around, I never have left AA, but I worked the steps kind of like a self-help program. And back then there was I'm okay, you're okay, the S training, all that stuff, which I did. And so I treated AA like another one of those. I didn't really get that how serious alcoholism was and how serious I needed to take the program. At step two, I was like, well, I've already been to 3 psychiatric hospitals. I've been labeled, you know, insane. And that's not why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got from listening, that the point was that the insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. This time, it'll be different. This time, I won't pass out. This time, I won't lose my car. This, you know, you can fill in the blank. So I came to understand when I was working the steps the second time with a new sponsor that I really had to throw away those old ideas of what I thought insane was and look in the context of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the book, I don't think I have time to read from the We Agnostics, but I'll just read a little bit. On page 44, it talks about if a mere code of morals was, you know, effective, then we wouldn't need a power greater than ourselves. But what really got through to me in We Agnostics is the part where it talks about lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power which by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? And that was when my sponsor helped me kind of work through what I didn't believe and come up with what I did believe. And it was a pretty simple concept that I learned when I was about 4 years old. And my beliefs have expanded now. Still pretty conservative, or not conservative, but, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic. I do enjoy a lot of other concepts in different areas of spirituality. So, but the point in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we find a higher power and that it's not us. And that is the main point of the big book, is to find a power greater than yourself that can solve your problem. Now, if you're new or nearly new or just given another whirl, my suggestion is that you don't go into these steps by yourself. Find somebody who has a quality about them of sobriety that you like and that's attractive. We call this a program of attraction, not a program of promotion. Also, although some of us are like P.T. Barnum some days up here. You know, but it's a program of attraction. And not naming names. And then at step three, we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And this, as for me, is ongoing. There's the third step prayer. It's simple. Some people say it every day. I've said it with my sponsor. And my suggestion at this time, these days, is that people put the date down in your book, not only of when your first day sober was, but when you do the when you take the third step. The reason that I ended up doing the steps twice is because I had kind of a breakdown at about 18 months sober, and I I stopped talking to my sponsor. I got real scared about my job. I eventually passed the bar, of course, got a job. The big lawyer job. And one thing my sponsor told me, and so I'm being kind of new and I don't usually talk about that job, because she said, you know, nobody cares. Here in AA, we're at even playing field, and that doesn't gain you any status. And you know, she said, a lot of people look down on lawyers. And so she's like, you're just best to keep that to yourself. And she knew that I was trying to, you know, that I had always used that as some sort of ratchet up. But little did I know it was a big step down. So I had this breakdown, And I was in the psychiatric hospital again because I didn't call my sponsor. When I called her from there, she said, "Did you eat breakfast?" You know, these are the things, right? Halt. And I'm like, "No, I didn't eat breakfast." And so they want to get me back on all these medications that I was on. I was on a lot of them for about 9 years before I got sober. And finally, I left there without any medication. They said, "We don't care what you do. Just don't try to kill yourself." Just, you know, so I'm like, "Well, I'll do the steps." So there, it took a few months for me to do the steps. But by that time, I had a moment. I was in the hospital and I was all out of ideas. It was late at night and I'm looking at this flashing, you know, light, the yellow light out the window, and I am praying that, and I didn't pray for anything. I just said, "I don't know. I have no idea." I didn't know if AA was going to work for me. I had special problems. I had different problems than you. Yeah. You know? And I didn't know if AA was going to do it, but I sure... peer pressure kept me sober then, because I had a big home group. They'd all been to my wedding. My husband was in the program. And so I was like, I got to do this thing. Sorry. Anyway, so I was something lifted eventually. I went to AA meetings. I wasn't really able to put sentences together very well for a while. My mother thought I should go back on the medications that I'd been on, and all these doctors and the lawyers that I worked for. You know, it was difficult, and I don't think that I necessarily broke my anonymity. I think I just said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And my boss said, "Well, if you're not going to do that, you're not going to work here." So I lost my job. And I went to the meeting in tears, telling I lost my job. I'd been home on the couch for months, and they'd been paying me. But anyway, sponsor said, "Oh, thank God. Thank God you lost that job, that thing that you were holding on to that you thought was your higher power or something like it." And so I did, and I knew the form of the fourth step. But that's next week. So I turned my will and my life over to a power greater than myself, and it was not easy going, but it was a lot better going. I can still say that my worst days sober have always been better than my best days drunk. So thanks. Now.
Is it on? Okay, there we go. Thanks, Carolyn. So do we have any questions from our audience? If you're here in the room, go ahead and raise your hand, then I'll bring you the microphone. And if you're on Zoom, just go ahead and speak up.
I just want to mention, I have to leave at 6:30 because I have to drive to Grove City. So in case I slip out.
Okay.
Thanks, Gina. Thanks. Was polite. Thank you.
Hey, Linda. Hey, Linda. Alcoholic.
How did you know,
even though all those doctors and lawyers and everyone with background education, like, how did you know to not go back to the meds and to, you know?
Let me be clear. The doctor that was treating me, not in the hospital, and not all these people that were kind of freelance friends of the lawyers that were calling and pressuring my husband. The doctor that was treating me 2 years or a year and a half prior to that said, I want you to go off of, I was taking lithium, because I want to see if you're, you know, how you're doing. And he'd been saying that for probably a year and a half prior to that. So I had, it wasn't anybody in AA that told me not to go back on it. I had my own experience that it didn't really work for me. And it was kind of scary, really. I mean, to say no to authority. So, but I did have a sponsor that shared with me, and some other people in my home group shared with me, and I had perfect examples. I had this one woman, she wouldn't stay with the program, and she was a PhD, brilliant person, and she was just completely lost her mind behind drinking and behind medications. And so I had some. I had two more examples that I won't go into, of people right in my face that were brought to, you know, that I could see. And so I thought, I'm going to put all my eggs in one basket and try AA. And my sponsor was willing to have me come over and sit on her couch, and I did. You know, I was afraid. That, so. I don't think anybody from the podium should say, go off your medication. That's certainly not my message. My message is that what my experience was.
Any other questions for Carolyn?
Hi, my name is Dan. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hi, Dan.
Did you, the very first time you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, did you come in and never go out again? I mean, never use again and
right.
Abuse? You came in, you stayed then,
yeah,
right?
I came to AA, and during that really rough period that I said where I had the breakdown, about 18 months, I didn't take any medications or use anything or drink, so I've been sober since October of 83. Yeah.
Hi, Carolyn. I'm Leslie, alcoholic,
well,
as,
hi, Leslie.
As you know. But I'm interested in what you have to say about this medical side and the whole thing. And I, too, and found myself placed in a secure facility for underneath it. The real reason was I was losing my crap on too much drinking. However, it was so easy to just, oh, here, you need this, honey, you take this Haldol and blah blah. I mean, they give you everything. It's insane. So I'd never heard anyone express it quite like that, that the men get locked up in jail and the women get locked up in hospitals. But now that you say it, I'm gonna ruminate on that a little and consider the truth of that statement. But, you know, one of the things, and I'm going to ask you what you think about this, one of the things my very first sponsor always told me, that an alcoholic gets depression and anxiety when they fail to work the steps, that part of our defense as alcoholics against those things are by working the steps and learning how to address life as it comes at us. And I'm wondering, did someone teach you something like that, or has that been your observation?
Well, it's been my experience, and you know, as you know, Bill Wilson had terrible depression and anxiety, and somewhere in the book, my big book thumping is not that great, but he talks about working with other people was the absolute solution to that nadir that he would find himself in. And I haven't experienced the can't get out of bed kind of depression. I did have that in that first breakdown thing. But I haven't experienced that since I worked the steps sincerely. And it's not a one and done, as you know. And I've continued to do 10, 11, and 12. And 12 really is the solution for me. And I think that's what Bill was really focused on as well.
Thank you.
Who else has a question? Anyone on Zoom?
Oh, the Kevin question.
We aren't getting out that early, so. At least not on the first few steps. Anyway, Carolyn, I just want to thank you for doing this. You are my favorite speaker.
You tell all the girls and guys that.
Hey, yeah. Guys, everybody. Anyway, you know, you talked about the third step, and then your third step, it seemed like your third step was more of a surrender than anything else. Is that the way it happened for you, and then did it grow from there, or could you,
Well, I think surrender is a good apt description. I think I really, when I say I did the steps again, I did do all those 20 incidences of step one, the 20 incidences of powerlessness with my second sponsor, but then I kind of, two and three I'd already done. That surrender probably was in the hospital that time when I was, I don't know what to do, but this is what I've got. Is Alcoholics Anonymous, and some strong suggestions from other people in AA to put all my eggs in that basket. So yes, and I don't know. I think my faith, if you will, has just grown over the years because I can look back over my shoulder and see where God has been active in my life. But only, I mean, not necessarily just because I'm asking for help, but because I did ask for help, and because he's there.
Thank you, Carolyn. I wanted to ask you about sponsorship regarding you having sponsees. Do you make them call you every day? Mine does. And I just thought, what?
I didn't call my sponsor for about 5 months when I was working early on. No, I don't do that. It wasn't my experience. My experience was I would meet my sponsor at meetings, and then I would go over to her house. And my when I've sponsored people, I'm happy to say one of my sponsees was here, Carmel. She's still here. But we would meet up when we were working the steps just weekly, and then you know, if there's an emergency, the people I sponsor, two people. Carmel lives in Ireland, right? So we Zoom or do FaceTime. Another woman lives in Vermont, and then a woman here. But we do a lot of texting's the thing. I don't. You know, I'd like to say, oh, we don't text, we just call on the phone or see you face-to-face, but that's not real, so, yeah. But it depends on the person, too. You know, it really does. Mm-hmm. Because if a person needs to call at 2 o'clock in the morning, then, you know, I think the biggest 12-step work we do now is to pick up our phone, to answer our phone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I also wondered, October 31st was your sobriety date. You weren't celebrating on Halloween or anything that night?
Well, here's how that happened. As a newcomer, I selected October 31st because when I first came, my sobriety date was in September, but I was still on all the medication and stuff. And so when I went back, it redoubled back around. I knew that I was off of all that stuff in October, by October 31st. And leave it to a newcomer to pick Halloween, you know?
Yeah. All right, thank you, Carolyn.
Oh. Did you say anything about that first meeting that you went to?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was led by Termite, and it was a group of bikers, and you weren't there. But John was there, and John sent me to another meeting, which was the Southside group, where just so happened Trevor H. was a member. Is that what you were looking for?